interesting questions, several in this vein, so I'll read one that covers some. Aren't the British being rather hypocritical when now, after well over half a century of colonial rule, they're trying to democratize Hong Kong in the 1995 elections, just 2 years before the Chinese take back Hong Kong?
It's actually more than half a century. It's 150 years. I tried to answer that point at the beginning of my speech, so either I didn't succeed or else the question was written before I began speaking, which has been known. I pointed out the difference between the way we had behaved in Hong Kong and the way we had behaved in all those colonial communities that we were preparing not for the resumption of sovereignty by another power, but for independence. When we negotiated the terms of the transition with China, we agreed in the joint declaration to which I referred the pace towards which we could move to democracy in Hong Kong. That was part of that international agreement. I'm not seeking to increase the pace of democratization in Hong Kong. But what I am saying is that the elections held according to the joint declaration under British sovereignty, I can't speak for what will happen under Chinese sovereignty, should be conducted on a basis which is fair and reasonable, that they should be credible elections, that they should be elections which produce a properly voted legislature, not elections which produce a rubber stamp. We all know that you can arrange electoral processes in a way which produces a preordained result. What we're talking to Chinese officials about at the moment isn't an increase in the pace of democratization, but it's what the arrangement should be for the elections 2 years before the transition to Chinese sovereignty. Those arrangements hadn't been agreed before Patton arrived in Hong Kong. Maybe people would have heard less about the 28th governor. If they had been agreed, maybe I'd have had a quieter life. They hadn't been agreed. We do have to agree them, and I hope we'll do so with good will on all sides in the course of the discussions we're having at the moment.
What do you tell the nervous business people in Hong Kong when they say you're just stirring up trouble with Peking, we have to live here when you leave?
Yes, some of them do, though I know that not all of those who criticize are in that category. Quite a few who are robustly critical, who have, like me, a British passport, or a Canadian passport, or an American passport. But I do think very hard about the almost 6 million people in Hong Kong who will be there after 1997, and that I think as well that if I'm not standing up for their way of life before 1997, there's rather less chance of anybody standing up for their way of life after 1997. A more fundamental point that I try to put to the business community is one that I touched on in my remarks earlier. Hong Kong hasn't been successful just because of the capitalist model of allocation of resources. Our way of life is about much more than capitalism. It's, if you like, about market economics operating within rules, within regulations, within the rule of law. Erode the rule of law and you knock away the foundations of Hong Kong's prosperity. How can you guarantee a commercial contract. If you haven't got the rule of law fiercely and fearlessly implemented. So businessmen who think that it wouldn't much matter if Hong Kong changed in its fundamentals better ask themselves what the credit rating would be if those things changed. They better ask themselves whether American banks would have quite as many assets locked up in Hong Kong if Hong Kong was no different from Shenzhen. They better ask themselves whether it might not be the case that some of the 15 American banks or 21 American insurance companies or 900 American firms or 26,000 American community who are in Hong Kong at the moment might not have nipped off to Taipei or Seoul or Tokyo or Singapore, where they might argue they could be rather surer about the rule of law. There is, I repeat, a close relationship between a free press, a credible legislature which isn't afraid to ask difficult questions, and the rule of law itself. And not to understand those things is to fail to comprehend one of the most fundamental aspects of our own society, yours here in North America and ours in Western Europe.
You mentioned rule of law. And this question, you talked about the rule of law being a key to Hong Kong's future, but isn't smuggling big business in Hong Kong these days?
Smuggling is all too big business. And something we suffer from in particular is the theft and smuggling of luxury cars. I think that if you were with us in Hong Kong, you would have heard yourselves anecdotes about what happens. You might even have heard about those who go north of the border to have serious discussions about how smuggling and car theft can be restricted and find themselves being driven around in right-hand drive Mercedes or BMWs. It is a problem. It's a problem that we're addressing with the authorities in the PRC, and a problem which we hope they will take seriously. Fortunately, we've managed to reduce the amount of car theft and smuggling over the last few months, largely, I hope, by some of the activities of the Independent Commission Against Corruption. That's been a very substantial move forward. But we still have to be extremely careful. We still have to be on our guard, and we need the active cooperation of the authorities in the PRC. One other thing which, of course, promotes smuggling is duties and tariffs. As we know in England from the history of Cornwall in the 18th and 19th centuries, the more you can have free trade, the less smuggling you have. It's another reason why about the only thing on which I'm ideological is free trade.
Japan, despite its phenomenal economic dealings with Hong Kong, has remained peculiarly silent about the issues regarding the reversion of the colony. What is your view on that?
We all have our different diplomatic styles. You're quite right to talk about the close relationship between Japan and Hong Kong. Japan has been one of the largest investors in Hong Kong. And Japan, like a number of other countries, has sensibly used Hong Kong as an investment gateway into China. Japan has, over the years, done us the great favor of appointing as consuls general in Hong Kong very distinguished diplomats. For example, the present vice foreign minister responsible for international economic relations, Matsuura-san, was consul general in Hong Kong. The present consul general was the private secretary to the last prime minister, Mr. Kaifu. So the Japanese take Hong Kong very seriously at a governmental level. I've had two visits to Japan since I've been governor myself, and they've both been extremely successful and rewarding. I'm sure that privately the Japanese will have expressed their concerns and interests to the PRC as they have expressed them to us and to the United Kingdom. But the Japanese haven't, over the last decades, made a habit of upfronting with their diplomatic concerns. I guess they're not going to change. All I want from Japan is a continuing close relationship and continuing Japanese investment in our burgeoning economy. And I suspect when the Japanese look around the world at other places where they might want to invest, the attractions of Hong Kong continue to look fairly substantial.
Many Americans feel very strongly that buying Chinese goods made with prison and child labor is morally wrong. Levi Strauss is the most recent American company to voice this concern. How can you address our concern in the absence of an MFN threat against China?
I think the question almost answers itself, because you've given examples of individuals or individual companies making their own decision and doubtless having some effect as a consequence. I think that human rights should be addressed in their own terms. Let me give you an example. At the moment, three countries, Australia, France, and the United Kingdom, have established a dialogue with China about human rights. China takes a particular moral position, of course, but we put our own arguments and put them pretty vigorously. I think that it's fair to say that you've done exactly the same from time to time, and I guess are doing that at the moment with some consequences. So I think that it's better to address China in a dialogue on human rights rather than to take blanket economic or trading decisions, which are unlikely to have, in my judgment, very much effect on those you would regard as the bad guys, even though they have quite a lot of effect on those who you would regard as the good guys. Let me tell you, give you an example of what I mean. The Wall Street Journal, in a leading article a couple of days ago, said that to revoke MFN wouldn't have all that much effect, it didn't believe, on people at the top, but it would have a tremendous effect on all those hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Chinese citizens who, because they'd started to take up a position in the market, had started to be able to flex their muscles, at least as economic animals, in the sort of way of which we'd all approve. I think it is better to help continue that economic process, that process of economic liberalism and economic freedom, rather than risk shutting it off.
What is your view of the Clinton administration's stance on textile trade? Do you see the free flow of textile trade or further restrictions?
Can I just add one footnote to what I was saying a moment or two ago? Because it's, I think it's an important point for us to make. And it's a point that I made to both Senator Mitchell yesterday and Representative Pelosi. There isn't an argument between us on the importance of improving human rights. If anyone has a right to be concerned about the issue, it's the people of Hong Kong. The people of Hong Kong who will, of course, be seeing the change of sovereignty in 1997. But there is a difference between us on how we can best secure an objective which we all feel very strongly, and people who will be living in Hong Kong after 1997 feel even more strongly about, if I may make the point like that. Textile trade. Well, I hope that we see a successful completion of the GATT. I hope we see a successful completion of the Uruguay round, and I hope on foot of that success, we see a steady reduction in trade friction, for example, in the textiles area, rather than the reverse. I don't think anybody gains from selective trade rows and the selective raising of trade barriers. I thought the President made a remarkable, a very good speech on this subject a few weeks ago. And in that speech, he pointed out that I think 20 out of the 24 developed countries had in the last few years raised trade barriers, even while I think his figure was 60 developing countries had been lowering trade barriers. His message was absolutely clear. We need to move steadily towards lower trade barriers all round. We need a successful Uruguay round. We need to reduce friction in areas like textiles, but in other areas as well. I feel that very strongly in Hong Kong, where textiles are extremely important to us. I feel that very strongly in Hong Kong, where I can speak for one of the very few communities where there aren't any tariffs at all. So, to borrow a phrase, we, as it were, put our money where our mouth is. I worry about the pressures for protectionism around the world. Pressures in Europe, pressures in the agricultural sector, the pressures which try to add some respectability to the argument by pretending that the only way we can protect our welfare standards, our community provision, is by shutting out the goods from other communities where welfare standards may not be so high. I worry about all those arguments and think that if we allow ourselves to drift down that road, we'll all rue the day, because it will have calamitous consequences for our economic development and economic growth. I do think that free trade is one of those issues where there are dangers as soon as you move away from an assertion of principle, and I hope we can avoid such a move.
40 years ago, the Democrats were labeled with the charge that they had lost China to communist oppression. Don't your proposals have a British domestic political purpose? Aren't they really designed to protect the Conservative Party from the post-1997 charge that they lost Hong Kong to communist oppression?
That may form the core of an opposition speech in some election subsequent to 1997. But I think if it does, it won't be a speech that gets much coverage. I don't honestly think that that is a charge that would stick. I'm not even sure that it's a charge that would be thrown, because I think it's inherently absurd. There has been no argument to speak of in British politics about the resumption of Chinese sovereignty in 1997. There have been arguments in the past about the terms of that resumption, and there have been arguments, though fairly moderate, on the pace of democratization in Hong Kong. At present, I think I can say with reasonable confidence, there is more cross-party support in Britain for what we're trying to do in Hong Kong than has been the case for a couple of decades. I hope that can survive, because I think we should be attempting to pursue a bipartisan policy in Hong Kong. What I would hope, looking beyond 1997, is that the United States and others, including Hong Kong, would have helped to ensure that China is a huge economic success, and without laboring the point, I think there are political consequences and social consequences of that, as I said earlier. So I would very much hope that the charge that was leveled rather unfairly against the Democratic Party 40 years ago would simply not be regarded as a runner in relation to 1997 and the years after that.
Will Hong Kong become the capital of Greater China? Is it already? Can you speculate on the role of Hong Kong 50 years from now?
In 2 minutes has been said from my right. I think there is a general recognition that Hong Kong is the capital of, as it were, the overseas Chinese, of the diaspora. And I think Hong Kong will always have a very special place in the hearts of the global Chinese community. I said that I thought that it would play a hugely important part in the development of the Chinese economy over the next few years, and I think it will play an important part culturally and socially as well. Speculating what's going to happen 50 years ahead is, of course, a pretty dangerous business, and I'm not sure how well qualified I am to do that. I recall that it's only 3 or 4 years ago that one of the most distinguished State Department thinkers predicted the end of history, and there seems to have been all too much history since then. I recall that it's only, I think, 4 or 5 years ago that one of the leading American academics, actually a British scholar, predicted that the Soviet Union would continue as a strong global power. He's just produced another book, I noticed, which I'm sure will be full of equally valid predictions about the... I didn't notice anything said about that prediction on the blurb. So I'm a little chary about predicting, but if you ask me to say what I would like Hong Kong to be like, I would like it to be continuing to excite virtually everyone who gets off the plane in Hong Kong with its verve and buzz and liveliness and can-do atmosphere, exactly some of the qualities which have attracted many of us to the United States, if I may say so, over the years, which may surprise you, but it's true. I would hope that Hong Kong would still be seen as a great open international city. I hope it would also be seen as representative of what we all mean and Karl Popper meant by an open society. I hope it will give, continue to give Adam Smith, as he lays unturning in his grave, cause for merriment. I hope, finally, that when you get off the plane in Hong Kong in just over 50 years' time, you'll be getting off at Chek Lap Kok rather than Kai Tak. But I suppose it's just about true that the joint liaison group or whatever succeeds, it may still be discussing the issue.
Before the final question, Governor, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation for appearing at the press club.
Thank you very much.
And a book on North American Indians.
Thank you
Picture
very much.
Picture book and text.
Thank you very much indeed.
Most welcome. Before, I missed telling you this before, and I'm supposed to be repeating it. Audio and video tapes of today's luncheon are available through the National Press Club Library or by calling 1-800-952-TAPE. All proceeds of the sale of tapes benefits the National Press Club Library. For the final question, many of us in this room are wearing suits made in Hong Kong, even though we've never been there. Should we order several suits now, or will they still be available after, or will they still be available after 1997?
I certainly think that you should go on ordering suits, shirts, shoes, and whatever else you wear. I can actually recommend a very good tailor who has spent much of the last few weeks, I'm gratified to say, taking my suits in. I would very much like to know how many members of Congress have their suits made in Hong Kong. And I want to assure you that the standards and style are higher than ever. There have been one or two problems in the past. A great friend of mine had a pinstripe suit made in a great hurry in Hong Kong about 30 years ago. And it was a terrific cut. The only problem was that they'd made the pinstripes horizontal. But that, I can assure you, is not the norm. There are very good tailors who will make your suits faster than you believe humanly possible, faster than they will subsequently take to dry clean when you come back to the United States. They will make them very fast, very cheap, in a most wonderfully friendly manner, and you wouldn't know, would you, from that a little advertising blurb that I'm the governor of Hong Kong. Something else which is very attractive in Hong Kong is porcelain and china, and we have very good design. And I'd like to offer you a small memento of this occasion, which I hope will remind you of Hong Kong, encourage you to come there, and encourage you to buy even more suits. I'm not sure, quite sure whether that one was made in.
You're looking at my Hong Kong suit. Good. Thank you.
Yes,
very
it's
much.
Very well cut.